On this upcoming special hour of the 21st, we tackle an important issue, children and trauma.
It's not just a head thing. It's not just what you see, but it changes how your body functions, so it changes your neurobiology. It changes how you respond to the world. It changes your social relationships.
That's Karen Sims. She joined me and a panel of others at a live event earlier this week at Riggs Brewery in Urbana. Working with the Illinois Newsroom, the event convened parents, teachers, and activists to talk more about trauma and how schools are helping children affected by what many are calling a public health crisis. Here's Champaign Unit 4 Schools Director of Special Education, Elizabeth Degree.
When I talk to teachers, I don't say to teachers, here's all the things that you're going to have to do. That's not going to happen. So labeling something a public health crisis allows for the leveraging of resources and the marrying in of community resources to school settings.
That's all coming up on our special hour-long broadcast of the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On today's program, you're going to hear a special hour of a community event we recorded in Urbana earlier this week. We focused on one important issue that affects kids, families, and educators all over the state from every socioeconomic background, helping children deal with trauma. When we say trauma, we're talking about everything from violence in their communities to problems at home, or maybe even having a medical condition that causes trauma. Whatever the cause, children who experience trauma can experience long-lasting effects. And where does this play out? For children in school. Educators spend a lot of time with children, and students affected by trauma have those problems show up in the classroom. So we convened an audience of parents, teachers, activists, and children to talk about how schools in Illinois are dealing with this issue. Lee Gaines first reported on this issue for the Illinois Newsroom. That's a new statewide reporting project based at Illinois Public Media. We partnered with them for the event. We were also joined by Karen Sims, founder of Meridian K Consulting. She works with families, teachers, and kids to better cope with trauma. Regina Kreider is the director of Youth Family Peer Support Alliance. She also advocates on behalf of youth and families affected by mental illness. She's also the pastor of Crossroad of Life Community Church. And Elizabeth Degree also joined us, director of special education for Champaign Unit 4 Schools. I spoke with Lee, Karen, Regina, and Elizabeth in front of a live audience at Riggs Brewery in Urbana on Tuesday night. I wanted to just start with Regina. You're based in Rantoul.
Yes, I am.
And together with your Youth Family Peer Support Alliance staff, you're working directly with families and youth.
Yes, we are.
Who are affected by mental or behavioral or emotional disorders. You're, as I mentioned, you're also a parent advocate, and your family has experienced this firsthand. So I wanted to just start by asking how this has affected your family.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for allowing me to be a part of the panel on today and being able to share our story. So trauma has affected us in a variety of ways. Our first experience with trauma is my daughter has severe asthma, and she went into respiratory failure when she was about 6 years old. So that was our very first experience of having a traumatic event. But then also as she went into the school system, she began to experience a lot of bullying, which created a lot of trauma for her because she began to become very anxious. She didn't want to go to school. She felt like people didn't like her. She resisted going to school. So our trauma has had to do a lot with her medical issues as well as what was happening when she's at school. So that's where we started our journey with dealing with the trauma that she has impacted her.
And how old is she now?
She's 18 now. She just actually turned 18 in November. She graduated early. I really have to say that the school district that we live in really helped us a lot. And so she walked across the stage in May. So we're transitioning from children's services to adult services, but she's doing really, really well.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I worked hard for that degree.
I was going to say, all the parents here know how much work goes into that.
Yes.
Do you feel like during her time in the school system that you got the support that you needed?
So my situation, I have to share with people that my situation was a little different from a lot of people. I've worked with a lot of families who have a lot of difficulty navigating the system, but because of the type of relationship that I had with both of the school districts that my daughter went to in the city schools and the high school, we had a lot of support. But that took a lot of relationship building. It took a lot of advocating. It took a lot of helping them to learn and to understand about my daughter, because there were things, teachers are teachers. They're not mental health professionals. So I felt it was my responsibility as her mother to teach them about her. Yes, this is what her anxiety looks like. Her anxiety may not look like other people's anxiety. This is what her depression looks like. So it was important for me to be her advocate in that aspect. And for the most part, they listened. They listened and they worked with me. And I believe that that was the reason why she was able to graduate.
And Regina, would you say that your experience was the norm? Or do you think lots of families who have children who have experienced trauma, are they having problems navigating the system, maybe don't have as much of a strong voice as you've developed?
I don't think that my situation was the norm. I do think that a lot of families have way more difficulty navigating the system, education system, mental health system. It's not that easy, but it can be done. But but once again, that's because I've worked with other families over the years, so I knew going into it what my daughter would need.
Karen Sims, we just heard Regina share her family story, and her particulars of her daughter's situation, of different experiences of how she's experienced trauma. You work with lots of people who are affected by many different forms of trauma, and I wanted to just ask you about that. Just as we're starting this conversation, what are we talking about when we say trauma in this context?
Regina hinted at a couple of things, but to think about it as having the broadest definition, so events, experiences, and exposures. So things that you've gone through, things that you have been around, so it doesn't necessarily have to directly impact you. And events, things that happen in the world. So if you can think about, just turn on the news, think about any current event for some of our young people and families. Those are really personal experiences. So we can talk about immigration, we can talk about terrorism, we can talk about gun violence, we can talk about community violence. All of those things in our surround are happening day to day. I mean, we just had potential tornadoes, right? So all of those things, if you are somebody who is sensitive, can impact you. And there's a researcher who does a lot of work in trauma, and he talks of Bissell Vanderklark. He's one of my favorite researchers because he does a lot of work with complex trauma. And he talks about, to think about it, is when you don't have the resources to deal with what happens to you, when things become out of balance, it is traumatic because it becomes too difficult to rebound for it. So if you think about why certain experiences impact people differently, certain people come in with more resources, more internal resources, more external resources like community supports, supportive neighborhoods, supportive schools. And so if I come in with more resources, a bad thing can happen and I can rebound from it. I can be resilient. When you start taking away those resources, a bad thing happens to me and it's harder to recover. It's also why the younger something happens to you, the more impactful it is, the more significant it changes. And I didn't say this explicitly, but trauma impacts in terms of the science. It's not just a head thing. It's not just what you see, but it changes how your body functions. So it changes your neurobiology. It changes how you respond to the world. It changes your social relationships. It changes everything from like your finances to your ability in terms of vocational aspiration. So it can completely dysregulate how you move in the world.
And you mentioned this when we were actually, I think when you were on the 21st, the last time, the same experience can happen to different children and children can respond to that in different ways.
Absolutely, because each one of us is unique, but also really think about what happens to them and also their own internal makeup, right? So each one of us is unique, but also what resources? Do I have a strong family support? Do people listen to me? Did they respond to me when I talked about how is the universe responding to me as a person really does make a difference. And we're all, right? So people are internalizers or externalizers, right? So some people act out, right? So sometimes I wear my pain on the outside and sometimes I take my pain out on myself. I mean, think about it in a week where we've had, five suicides that we're aware of?
Celebrity.
Yeah, five celebrity suicides that have been in the news. Those are examples of people who took their pain, right, internally and suffered primarily silently. And so people respond to the world, right, differently.
Why do you think it's important to see that what's happening? Why do you think it's important to have this lens of trauma when we're thinking particularly around children and schools and education?
For a number of reasons, and probably one is the most obvious. So I think if you talk to an educator, if you talk to someone in human services, people say and reflect that things feel different. My mom was an educator for a really long time. My daughter was a first-year teacher this year, and I got a chance to go down to Atlanta to see her at her school. I talk to teachers a lot. And long-term teachers will say there's a complexity of needs and that students seem to want and need more. Families say that their kids are more complex. And part of that isn't just theory. So researchers are saying that that is indeed fact, because the more we make families fragile, the fewer resources they have, the harder it is for families to recover, for kids to recover when bad things happen. And so the part two of that is, because of how trauma impacts the brain, traumatized brains can't learn. And so
what does that look like?
Okay, the simplest answer, right? So we could have a long science conversation, but just to think about the function of cortisol, right? You guys have seen all the cortisol, right? So just think about when you've experienced a lot of stress. So trauma, in fact, impacts you like a lot of stress. And when what the function of cortisol is, it creates foggy thinking. And the more stressed you are, the foggier your thinking is. So to think about everything that when we talk about a trauma-informed lens, a lot of times we're talking about helping you calm down enough so that you can hear, which means that I've got relationships, I feel safe, I can hear you. Because again, a traumatized, and then the other piece around trauma is learning expectations have increased exponentially, right? So we expect a kindergartner to come in ready to read, ready to learn. So we've upped the ante while there are so many other stressors that make that learning, that complex learning, more difficult. And so if we don't have a trauma-informed lens, we don't think whole brain and can't get learning through in the way that's meaningful. So we have sort of social and emotional needs, and we have academic needs sort of right at war with each other when we don't, right, when we don't think about how trauma is sort of impacting students and their families. I don't want to, right, because kids exist in the context of families, and sometimes we get really focused on the kids and forget that they got adults in their lives who also have needs.
Lee Gaines is also here with us. Why did you report this story? How did this all come about?
I just started hearing about trauma in the community, and I heard about Karen's work at the Champaign Community Coalition and these trauma workshops she was doing. And then right around the same time, Illinois Newsroom decided that we were going to take a deep dive into downstate gun violence. Chicago obviously absorbs a lot of attention when it comes to violence and specifically gun violence. And we as a collaborative wanted to focus more of our attention on what was happening in some of the smaller communities throughout Illinois, because we knew that this was a problem from some of the data that we collected. So I wanted to think about, well, how does that impact children? And trauma immediately came to mind. And to be honest, I was looking for an excuse to talk to Karen because I found her workshops fascinating. So it was one conversation that she and I had that really struck a chord with me, which is exactly what she just said, that a traumatized brain can't learn. So I just began thinking of all these children in all of these classrooms across the state who are dealing with trauma and their grades are suffering because of it. And I wanted to understand more about why that was happening. And I think one of the biggest key takeaways for me from my reporting on this is how important relationships are. And what I kept hearing over and over again is if you do one thing for some of these children, make sure that they have a supportive adult relationship in their life that can really go a long way to mitigate some of the experiences that they're some of these negative, what we would call adverse childhood experiences they're having. And I think the other thing I took away from this is that it's not just exposure to violence, it's a whole host of things that can cause trauma for children. And essentially, if you don't have those support networks in your life, something that might not be traumatic to a child with those support networks that already has those positive adult relationships might not be traumatic for them, but it will be extremely traumatic and might have really long-term effects for a child without that. So it's kind of going in and providing them those adult relationships that's really key.
Elizabeth Dickrey is also with us from Unit 4. And Elizabeth, as we're talking about this, I just wanted to ask your perspective of if you think this is more of a problem today, or are we maybe getting better at recognizing and identifying these challenges?
I think yes and yes. So, you know, when I was in school, when I was in teacher prep, we did not have these conversations ever. And there are some teacher prep programs that are having them now, but we did not have them. And you're right. You know, teachers are teachers. They're not therapists. They're not clinicians. And in our training, we don't ask them to be therapists or clinicians. But teachers do have some really powerful relationship pieces to leverage, as well as the relationships that they can have with kids and families, as well as the level of stability that they can provide in kids' lives. In our community, going back to some of the things that Karen was saying, you know, we talk about how we're not Chicago. But the reality is, if you look at rates of violence, rates of gun violence in Champaign County, rates of reports, rates of poverty, rates of confirmed DCFS reports, rates of kids in care, we're higher than Cook County in the majority of those characteristics. So it is increasing. In our county, we have a lot of kids in care, which means that kids have been likely removed from their home.
And so by care, you mean DCFS?
I mean DCFS, yes. So kids have probably been removed from their home as a result of some kind of traumatic event or traumatic event for their parent that the child is experiencing as well. So we are seeing more of an impact, and we also have better knowledge.
You've been hearing from Karen Sims, Regina Kreider, Elizabeth Dickrey, and Lee Gaines. They all joined me earlier this week in front of a live audience in an event hosted by the Illinois Newsroom to talk about the problem of trauma among our children and what we all can do about it. We'll hear more from this conversation on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in, we've been sharing a conversation we recorded earlier this week in front of a live audience in Urbana. It was about how trauma affects children and what schools can do about it. I sat down with Elizabeth Dickrey from Champaign Unit 4, Regina Kreider with the Youth Family Peer Support Alliance, Karen Sims from Meridian K Consulting, and education reporter Lee Gaines. Here's a little more from that discussion. I wonder what this looks like when we think about income disparities, when we think about racial disparities, what trauma looks like among our children, and if this is something that's disproportionately affecting children who are coming from more low-income backgrounds, and I'm curious about the racial disparities as well. Karen, do you want to start?
So that's a loaded question. So trauma is an equal opportunity employer, right? Like anybody can be impacted by trauma. But I think I said, when you have fewer resources, it is harder sometimes to rebound. And so poverty and racism, right, structural inequities, sometimes keep you, limit your access to some resources. The other reason to think about how that operates, I was talking to a researcher earlier, they're doing some prenatal work and looking at maternal works. But to think about it, if I am stressed while I'm pregnant because I don't have access to resources, there's going to be more cortisol, right? More if I don't have access to adequate nutrition, if I am stressed when I'm pregnant, there's going to be probably some nutritional challenges that are going to impact my baby's ability to sort of have resources. If I come out and I don't have social supports, there's more complexity. And so poverty, unfortunately, and structural inequities sometimes disproportionately means that a bad thing that happens makes it harder to recover, both physically, emotionally, across the board, just because of those structural inequities. And so there's actually a couple of research projects that are happening nationally. One project out of NYU gave moms $100 a month extra that didn't count against her benefits, and found that babies born were larger, had better development, had less cortisol, because they can measure that, just by having an extra $100 a month to offset. And the science around poverty, and which is a traumatic experience, says that children who grow up in extreme poverty sometimes look like they've lost 10 IQ points, and a trauma-informed response that, particularly with the wellness orientation, which means that we're making sure that you have the right amount of food and the right amount of supports, you get those IQ points by just having the right interventions. Right?
And go ahead, Elizabeth.
And those pieces go together in childhood. So like Karen's saying, if you live in poverty, you're more likely to experience food insecurity. You're more likely to experience homelessness. You know, there could be issues with drug use or domestic violence. Then those, you know, are two that sometimes go together. So there are pieces that have tendencies to go together. And like you were talking earlier, the more ACEs a child has or a student has, the greater the impact, both right then and long term.
And I want to add to that in regards to access. That's primarily to me one of the, as a parent, of working with parents who have these challenges, is navigating systems and being able to actually access what's needed. And a lot of times there's programs, there's resources that are developed and provided, but they don't necessarily meet the need of what the family actually needs. And so it's important to develop something or create something with the input from families, and not just someone, a group of professionals saying, hey, we think that this is what's best because we've done this, we've done that, we've done this research and pulled it. But let's bring families to the table and say what really works, because you can conceptualize something and think it's grand and great and it's going to really make a big difference in families' lives, only for the service to not be used. And you're like, well, why aren't parents coming out, or why aren't kids coming out? Because it's not kid friendly, not family friendly. Family didn't have a voice in it, because they will come and support that which they have felt a part of. And having access is crucial. And a lot of families, even living in Rantoul, which is the third largest community in Champaign County, is still a rural community. And it's a rural community with very limited resources. And so there's a lot of unmet needs when it comes to food, clothing, shelter, systems navigation. Access to just getting help to get around the systems is critical. And I think a lot of people fall through the cracks, families and kids fall through the cracks, because they don't have the appropriate access.
Let's talk about the solutions. But before we get to that, I just wanted to ask you, Karen, one question. And it's part of what Lee's reporting was. You said this was a public health crisis. Why do you think it's important to say that?
I want to go to something Regina said first,
okay,
and then I'll answer
fine.
That. So we said ACEs, and I just want to make sure everybody knows that we're talking about adverse childhood experiences. So there are 10. If you want to go investigate it, it's important to know about that. And Regina said something around access to services. And one of the beautiful things that caused me to think about why I love trauma-informed schools is you cannot have a trauma-informed schools without having an integrated framework where all of the community resources, services, and supports are integrated, where the community feels meaningfully involved in the lives of kids and families in that building, and that building feels like it's a connection to the community. That is a core part of the model, and I guess I wanted to say. So,
yes.
So access is, I mean, a lot of the trauma-informed schools have a one-stop shopping framework so that parents don't have to navigate different programs and services. Those services are embedded in the school building. As you can imagine, I talked about like how complicated it can be for families who have needs to get those needs met. Well, if they come to you, you've eliminated that barrier and created access. But also, if I feel safe at school, hypothetically, I'm gonna write best intention, school is a good place. I'm going to assume that if the school brings in a mental health provider or a substance abuse provider or a food program or any of those resources to meet my needs, that they've been vetted. And the school says that they're good people, too. Mm-hmm. And I'm more likely to participate in those services. If you think about the burden, if you've ever tried to navigate public transportation, I'm going to pick on Champaign, right? I'm not in Rantoul, which is like a whole nother story,
yes.
Right? But imagine if you have a child who needs medical care over here, and then maybe you want to take them to the dentist over here, and then maybe if you've ever tried to go to food banks, you've had to like maybe go to two or three. And if you've ever tried to do that on public transportation, Right. That's it, right? Everybody's like, yeah, right? If you just tried to take the bus anywhere, but if you have those services that come to you, things that we complain about in terms of non-compliance or non-participation or non-follow-through are just about the logistics. It's a struggle to sometimes just do the day-to-day, but when we ease the burden, families get the supports they need, which is part of a trauma-informed framework.
Absolutely.
So the reason why it's a public health approach, right, is because it is not just about what schools can do, but it's about what mental health does, what social service providers do, what after-school programs do, what recreation does. Everybody's involved in this, and so we want to deal with not only the symptoms, so problems that you might see in schools or in the community, but also the root causes. And some of those root causes are structural inequities. People talk about adverse community experiences, so the structural things that exist that feed into poverty. So when people don't have extra resources or toxic masculinity or all those structural pieces that sort of feed into trauma, we want you to address those too. We don't want you to just sort of, again, pay attention to, like, no Band-Aids, because that doesn't get to the, that doesn't heal trauma.
Right.
Like, we really have to think about complex solutions. And it's integrated. We can't get to healing trauma without building protective factors, and that's all of our jobs. Everybody in this room has a role to play in building protective factors.
Elizabeth, Karen said a couple times a trauma-informed response. Can you explain a little bit more about what that means?
I have a couple of different things that I want to address from that perspective. Labeling something a public health crisis allows the leveraging of resources that we do not currently have. And so what Karen is describing sounds fantastic, but there's nobody in this room that thinks that schools are able to do that.
Yeah.
So when I talk to teachers, I don't say to teachers, here's all the things that you're going to have to do. That's not going to happen. So labeling something a public health crisis allows for the leveraging of resources and the marrying in of community resources to school settings. If you look at some of the things that our district is doing in terms of community schools, you know, we have some services that are now based at Garden Hills Elementary. It is not a full service model. And
those are social services.
Yes. It is not a full service model in terms of being able to come there, families being able to come there and get all their needs met. Until we have a community that says, this is a public health crisis for us, schools will not be able to do that. And I think we need to be really honest about that. What schools are able to do every single day is work with the kids who are in front of them in a trauma-informed manner. We've done it with 12 of our buildings so far, and we're going to be finishing up the rest of the buildings next year. It's some just very initial work, and it has to do with some of the basic things that Karen was talking about that adverse childhood experiences study. So let's first learn, why is this important? Is it a real thing? Because there are people who don't believe it's a real thing. And that is not labeled, not limited to school people, right? There are plenty of people in the community that don't believe it's a real thing. So what are adverse childhood experiences? How do they play out for kids at school and in the community? Talking about those cortisol brain pieces. So when we're talking about that, that kicks kids into that fight or flight and they can't get out, right? That's an adaptive response for us, that fight or flight. But if kids can't get out, then they are going to treat everything that approaches them as though it's a threat. That's part of that training, is just some of those basic understanding pieces. Then we look at what are our tiered supports in terms of the kinds of things that we should be doing across the building, the kinds of things that are more targeted, and the kinds of things that individual kids need. And then the last piece that we deal with in our initial training is self-care and understanding secondary traumatic stress for educators. Because the reality is that our teachers and staff take on the struggles of their students, and they make those struggles their own, and they begin to have that same, and the same thing happens with care workers and advocates. When you make those struggles your own, you begin to have some of that same, that same symptomology that we see in kids plays out in our adults, and then they're no longer able to support our kids as well as they might be able to.
Can I ask all of you a question? It's something that you said, Elizabeth. For people who do not believe that this is a real thing, what do you say to them?
Well, I show them, in schools, we show them all of the school outcomes, right? So kids who...
You show them the data.
We show them the data. But we put it all together so that it's like, here it is, lower graduation rates, lower grades, higher dropout rates, lower attendance, lower participation in post-secondary education. So all of the things, higher discipline rates, all of the things that schools measure and want to be successful on are negatively impacted by kids who are experiencing trauma and bringing that into schools.
So with the work that we do at the Alliance, we have the privilege and the honor of working with parents one-on-one, and we provide peer support. And in our supporting our peer, because we also have lived experience, meaning that we've walked in the same shoes as them. So one of the things that we do, it's an opportunity for us to introduce the ACE to families so that they can begin to understand and to begin to see how trauma has impacted their life. What I have found oftentimes is if parents go to the school and they hear, you know, staff talking about, well, your child has trauma or there's trauma, there's a wall that instantly goes up because it's not something that they necessarily understand. But one of the things that I do want to say that I think is really important is for, going back to my point earlier, it's important for families to be a part of the process of understanding what is the school doing. So you're doing the ACE. What does that mean? You're doing tiered services. What does that mean? How does that affect me? How does that apply to me? How can I bring that back home and be able to help to bridge the gap between home and school? I think a lot of times, a lot of things happen within schools at a very quick rate because change needs to happen quickly. And so there's not a lot of time to educate parents or families about what's going on. And there's this expression out there in the systems of care world, nothing about us without us, but there's a lot that happens without parents' knowledge, understanding, input, their approval within the schools, which they don't have to, but you will get more buy-in and support if parents are better educated so that they can be a part of the process. And it's better to pay on the front end by doing the education and investing than to do it on the back end, because I have been in the school system for 24 years, and I've seen so many models come through, just like schools have seen so many models come through, and whatever is hot and new for that year or that 2 years we're doing, but then we move on to something else. It was PBIS for a few years. Now it's trauma-informed care. Families are not rolling with this the same way in the same rate as schools, and so I think it's important to engage families in that process.
You asked a question about what does it mean to be trauma-informed, and I think some of what is being hinted at. So being trauma-informed means is that you're realizing the impact of trauma, so you're seeing it, so making sure you're recognizing that some of the things that you see are a result of trauma, so you're recognizing it in your surround and sort of narrating that. You are making sure that you respond to trauma in a way that's sensitive so that you're responding to the needs of people impacted by trauma, and then you're avoiding re-traumatizing people. So everything Elizabeth highlighted, right, and that Regina just talked about, the reason why you want to have families involved is you want to make sure that your responses to families aren't re-traumatizing. Because a lot of times families come in with their own stories about schools, and we want to make sure that families feel safe, and that we want to make sure that families, if you're a parent, right, you want to make sure that your kid feels safe, and if you're not included in your kid's learning, you don't feel safe. And so it sort of fits. So when you think about trauma-informed, you're thinking about all of those four levels of support, and you're making sure that everything that you do around policies, procedures, and practices fit within those four domains.
You've been listening to a live event we recorded earlier this week in Urbana, focusing on the issue of trauma in schools. When we come back, we'll finish up that conversation and hear some of the questions we got from the audience. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You've been listening to a discussion we had earlier this week in front of a live Urbana audience about how to help children in schools all across Illinois deal with traumatic experiences. We've made that conversation available during this special hour-long broadcast. I talked with Elizabeth Degree from Champaign Unit 4, Regina Kreider with the Youth Family Peer Support Alliance, Karen Sims from Meridian K Consulting, and Illinois Newsroom Education reporter Lee Gaines. Here's the rest of our conversation, which included some questions from the audience. I wanted to ask, Elizabeth, just to Karen's point, what does Unit 4 do? How do you involve, and to Regina's point too, how do you bring parents and families into this conversation?
Most recently, we did a session at our Parent Comm University. Our Parent Community University, our Director of Community Schools and Family Engagement, she and her team did a Parent University where we talked about a variety of different things. The parents came in, we had a keynote speaker, they had dinner, and then we had a variety of sessions. And we actually talked to families about some of those very early trauma in the brain, like when you look at the brains of infants. And we talked about some of those very early pieces, including and also what we're doing. So that's the most recent thing. Going back several years, we have provided parent training in our youth mental health first aid. And that's a training that Karen was one of our initial partners in providing that training. We've had a lot of parents and community members participate in that training. We've trained over 500 people, and a little over half of them are not our staff members. We've really worked on training a lot of people throughout the community. It was a training that we offered and continue to offer for free.
Elizabeth, I have a question for you. As we're talking about how we get parents involved in this work and how we make parents feel safe and supported as well as their kids, I'm wondering what kind of support do teachers need, or what are they telling you they need in order to be effectively trauma-informed? Is it more resources from the state, or is it a mind shift in their administrators? What do they need to be the best that they can be and help these kids?
I have heard both of those things. I have also heard better techniques for behavior management, better ways to kind of distinguish when kids' behavior is related to trauma versus related to something else. More education in general. What kinds of things do we need specific to our school population? Because although we're a community, although we're a unit school district, different buildings have different needs. And so teachers are asking for all of those things. One of the other pieces that we're working on as part of this, and this is relative to what teachers have said they need as well, is understanding that as part of this training, I'm not asking any of our teachers to be clinicians. That's not what this is about, but every single adult, and I say this when I talk to community people too, every single adult who comes into every single kid's life has the opportunity to be one of those safe, supportive adults. And we talk about how healing from trauma occurs in the context of supportive adult relationships. And so every teacher, even if they don't have a much broader skill set, can work on that piece initially, and then we build from there.
Before we get to questions, I just wanted to ask all of you a question. Is this more about changing the mindset of adults?
At some level, it's always about the adults, because the kids are going to leave. You have a group this year, next year you're not going to have them, or you might have one or two. The kids are going to leave. We need to work on building our adult skill sets for longer term things to get better for us as a school community, and we also need to intervene with individual kids. It really is both.
Elizabeth, I think you said at one point during our interview that it's moving adults from a place of asking what's wrong with kids to what's happened to kids.
And that's, you'll hear all of us say that, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I didn't make that up. So, you know, it is about that mind shift. Instead of saying, like, what's wrong with you? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this to me? What has happened to you? Why is this playing out for you the way that it is? What is the cycle that you are in and not able to get out of? How can we de-escalate you so that we can deal with this situation and move forward?
Why don't we go to some audience questions? I think Kristen has the microphone. So please speak into the microphone your question.
Alrighty, I am an educator at Champaign Central, and as you guys were going through this conversation, one of my former students came to mind. He had been abused by an adult male when he was very young, and that came through as we were trying to figure out how to help him. Obviously, as an old adult male myself, I already became a kind of re-traumatizing figure in his life. How do you, or do you have any advice when obviously avoidance or neglect would be another traumatizing situation, if there's not really a way you can help that individual without becoming a re-traumatizing presence in their life? Do you have any advice as far as addressing that?
From a school and teacher perspective, I think that oftentimes we are asked to repair relationships that we did not break. So yes, you could absolutely be a trigger for that child. You could also be the person that breaks that as a trigger for that child. And that's all I'll say, and I'll let someone who's a clinician answer.
Well, that's the short, right? That's the short answer. And those are, I mean, when we're talking about complex, so, right, we didn't talk about degrees of trauma, but there are different types of trauma, and recovery is a different process. And so that's the kind of thing that I think, when you think about those tiers of support, really like thinking about what were those tier one interventions, what did you try, what were those things, could be around certain kinds of things around discipline, that you don't become the primary figure that does that in to certain degrees. And so working with a system to support you being a trauma-informed teacher is super important, right? And so that's, so to think about what are those policies, procedures that allow you to be the best person for your student, particularly for students with complex trauma. And so a student who was violated by a trusted adult, or like if you get violated by a teacher, those traumas are much more difficult to heal, because when someone close to you hurts you, it becomes harder to trust any adult.
And I would add to that is to have the family involved in that process, because a lot of times a parent or a family member can give you insights or share things that the school may be trying to figure out, that if you engage the family in that problem-solving process or looking at the tiered levels and how it's going to be scaffolded, they can give you some insight that you may not even know or could be overlooking. So I think it's imperative to continue to keep the family involved and engaged in the process.
And just to follow up with that, Karen, Elizabeth, how does that work? And Elizabeth, I don't know how this works within your schools. I wonder if teachers oftentimes, if these are difficult conversations. So how do we equip teachers to have these conversations with family members? In this particular case, this could be a really tough conversation.
I think one of the things that is really important is to understand the limits of your skills. And so I know that if I'm sitting in a space next to Karen, that she has much better clinical skills than I do. I may have a better relationship with the child. And so that's the way that I leverage that piece to then also say, this is a trusted person. I understand that you have this situation. I really don't know what to say. And it's okay to say to kids, we don't know what to say. I'm here to listen to you. I would like to also have you talk with someone who I believe can help you and I trust. Yes, on the family piece, except occasionally what we see in schools is that kids report to us and it is an immediate family member. And as a teacher, that is so far out of our wheelhouse. Knowing the limits of your skills and who you should leverage in to help while still being a trusted person for that child is really, really important for teachers to be able to do.
And last but not least, there's this concept called mirroring neurons, right? So if I believe that you're not going to like me, chances are you're not going to like me. So a lot of the teacher preparedness is you being your own best instrument and sort of figuring out, like, what's triggering me? What's getting me activated? What makes me anxious? Because if I'm not, again, if I don't have good executive functioning, if I'm not well-regulated, if I'm not in a good place, it is impossible for me to be good for my students. And so sometimes we create, just by our own anxieties, we create more of a process, which is normal. And so what are the supports that exist? Maybe it's your mindfulness activities and thinking through that allows you and equips you and affords you more opportunity to connect. Because if you're afraid of, right, our fears become contagious. And there's actually been some research that says that, like, we can create lots of, you know, anxiousness in a classroom when we're not good.
And anybody who's been a teacher for a little while has had a kid come up and say something to you that you want to go, ew. And, You know, being able to maintain your face, even if you want to make that face, and saying, that's really serious, and I don't really know what to do with that. I need some help. Especially for a kid who is seeking help, also having an adult say, I need help, that normalizes that too.
So I have a question. I'm a doctoral student in the Spanish department at Illinois, and my question is about language barriers and the experience of trauma as well in immigrant communities. So I think that, for example, I've had the experience of translating or interpreting at student-teacher conferences at Champaign High School, and many of the families, actually, I noticed, were not native speakers of Spanish. They're speakers of a Mayan language called Canjobal. Uh-huh. And so I wonder, how can we make families feel safe, for example, when we don't speak their language or when social services don't exist in the language that they speak?
We have kids with over 70 native languages in Champaign, just in our district. So I have no question that we do not have services in those languages. We do the best we can, and we hook up with places like the Refugee Center, other going back to community resources piece. That is also a time that having a peer family can be very, very effective with some of our immigrant communities.
And when you say peer family, can you just define that? When you say a peer family?
When I say a peer family, I mean another family who has had a similar immigration story.
Okay.
I mean, we have large immigrant refugee communities here. So if you're talking about some of those pieces, and our Guatemalan families certainly fall under that umbrella, there are other families who are more established, our parent liaisons hook families up together, and that can be really helpful. But in terms of the services, you're absolutely correct.
Some of the work is just recognizing that it is a traumatic experience, right, as a baby step. That I think frequently people don't think about the obstacles, burdens, the emotional hurdles. And if you structure the meeting with an acknowledgement that it is a traumatic experience and that even the miscommunication makes it more difficult, then sometimes even the lens in which we look at things and how we narrate and the expectations or even the plans might be different once you realize all the different variables. I mean, that's why that realizing trauma is so important, because so often I mean, I sit with people all the time, and I'm sure you've seen it, where what we see looks like one thing, and once we hear the complexity of the story, we're like, no, like, I see you, and it's not the thing that I think it is. But if I don't ask the question, I get caught up on the surface, and I come up with all kinds of responses that don't resonate with your own lived experience.
Right.
And so how is it that we really look to see people and really hear them and respond to them in a way that's authentic and true and that equips them with the opportunities for, like, recovery?
Mm. Well, thank you all, ladies, for being here this evening. So I want to thank Regina Kreider again, director of the Youth Family Peer Support Alliance, and pastor at Crossroads of Life Community Church, Elizabeth Degree, who is the director of special education for Champaign Unit 4 Schools, Karen Sims, founder of Meridian K Consulting, and of course, the Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines, who we would not have been here tonight without assembling all of these people. Thanks to everyone who came out for this event. It's actually the first in a series of conversations called News and Brews, hosted by the Illinois Newsroom. Special thanks to Riggs Brewery for letting us use their space. And of course, thanks to everyone who made this happen. Kristen Walters, Lee Gaines, Scott Cameron, Jason Croft, and Steve Mork. That does it for us this week. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. If you look for us on Facebook, you can search for the 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.